Before we start, here's a quick reminder. If you're a native English speaker, the following introduction will be entirely in Chinese. Feel free to skip this part by dragging the timeline to the 6 minute that's where the conversation begins. If you are bilingual or you want to go through it, you are more than welcome to stay. The intro will provide you some ideas on what inspired this episode. 欢迎收听读报。这是一档杂志文章的阅读分享节目，我们的目标是希望借助外文报道看到更多的人和故事。我们相信总有人对外面的世界有所兴趣与好奇。 Asian characters entering cyber world without an actual embodiment。
So on one hand, you know, you can look at it aesthetically, you know, as we've done. But on the other hand, you know, we can also look at it more sociologically.
Both of them challenge traditional representation of Asian characters.大家好，欢迎收听读报，这是我们的第37期，也是久违的特别节目。哎呀，这一期太波折了，关了将近一年，终于等到放出来的机会。去年这个时候我开始上一门叫做 Race and Technology 的课，在这个课上呢，老师带我们研究了很多影视作品里面，尤其是好莱坞影视作品里面对亚裔形象的展示。当时也是颁奖季，那个时候瞬息全宇宙风头正盛，杨紫琼也众望所归的拿下了去年奥斯卡最佳女主角。不久之后 Beef 怒呛人生 Past Life 过往人生都陆续上线，也在亚裔包括东亚观众里掀起了讨论的热潮。在整个2023年中，我们看到了越来越多以亚裔为主角的影视作品出现。在今年的颁奖季中，刚才提到的两部片子也势如破竹， Steven Yeun 和 Ali Wong 都拿下了各自的金球奖杯， Past Life 则拿下了美国国家影评人协会年度最佳影片奖。在现在这个时间点来推这期特别节目，一方面是因为颁奖季的东风，另一方面也是希望借这个机会提供一个新的讨论的视角。算到现在瞬息全宇宙上映已经一年快两年了，那在这个期间越来越多亚裔相关的影视作品出现，而且除了讨论移民种族，也涉及了很多对女性主义的讨论。以我个人的体验来说，确实也是在瞬息全宇宙之后，我对内容的摄入开始发生了转变。如果说以前看日剧看韩剧仅仅只是看待一个slightly different 的镜像群体如何生活在高度相似的环境里，那相比之下 Asian immigrant 则是跟我完全不同的独立存在的一个群体。这个群体多年来都纠缠于确立特异性，纠结于确立一种 distinction， 他们有很多独属于自己的属性，与我有相似的源头，但是其实最后长成了不同的样子。我想强调的是，这种相似跟不同在 sci-fi 的场域里会格外的清晰。所有的 fiction work， 包括小说包括影视剧，并不是真正发生在我们身处的世界上，而是发生在创作者所建设的一个空间里。在内核上所有的这些 fiction work 跟 sci-fi 都有一些相似之处，就是大家都是被创造出来的空间，但又携带着现实世界的重量。现实世界里所有的问题在 sci-fi 世界里都会一个不落的存在。所以我也觉得虽然这期节目或许并不是百分百的踩中热点，但是所涉及的分析范式是不受时间跟空间影响的。那在这期节目里我邀请了当时 Race and Technology 的负责老师，我们从一个关键的理论范式 ornamentalism 切入，讨论了好莱坞对亚裔女性的角色的塑造在不同场域里所经历的不同的阶段。我们也结合了彼此自身的经验以及作为亚裔的共同感受，我们试图靠近两个问题。一，这些影视剧是不是开拓了亚裔女性在好莱坞作品中新的形象塑造的方式，以及更重要的，他们是否给出了在呈现人这方面的新的范式和可能。 本期节目是用英文录制的，而且当时碰到了一些技术问题，我用了两个麦收音，但是挂在我自己身上的那个小蜜蜂完全没有录到。老师用的那只麦呢，录他的声音没有问题，但录不太到我的那个，听上去仿佛就是从山顶传过来，但其实我们两个就是面对面坐着，所以后面我就只能给我自己的部分重新配音。但没有办法抹掉的是，老师那边的音轨上其实压了一些我的碎片，基本上不影响表意，但是在听感上你可能会听到同一个人有两种截然不同的声音状态，有点分裂。毕竟后面的重录其实是没有办法找回对话的状态的。另外是这次的对话比较短，是可以做逐字稿的程度，所以也准备了中英文两份逐字稿供大家参阅。翻译是 GPT 和通译千物完成的，我负责了最终的校对和编辑。Literally, lots of technology involved in making this special episode about tag and race. Anyway, hope you enjoy it.
Kind of, you know, what kind of self-introduction, you know, would you like?
I will start with a short introduction in Chinese to tell the audiences why we wanted to talk about this topic at this particular time, because it has been a while. Both Oscar and Beef has been quite a while. So there will be short introduction, and then I'll introduce briefly about your background, and you're the professor of this particular class, and then you can go on introduce yourself, for example, the research interest and why you are here for this special episode.
Oh, okay, sure, yeah.
So as long as you are ready.You wanted to introduce yourself to everyone?
Okay, hi, my name is Alina Chia, and I'm a lecturer at Goldsmiths, University of London. I'm here at the Department of Media, Communications, and Cultural Studies, and the film, as well as the other media representations of Asian Americans, you know, are relevant to my work, particularly because I study automation in cultural industries, and overall, there is a...popular discourse in which Asians, and East Asians specifically, have been portrayed in the media in a roboticized fashion. And that has knock-on effects not only for public discourse. So, you know, for example, you know, when you think about outsourcing in different kinds of cultural work, in different kinds of tech work, it has knock-on effects that goes beyond, you know, the screen, beyond fiction,into the popular culture, into popular discourse.
So let's start with some initial feelings about this film, Everything Everywhere All at Once. It has been a while. I'm sorry about procrastination. But if I remember correctly, you first watched it on the plane, right?
Yes, I watched it on a plane, and I watched it just as the meal was being served. So my initial thoughts, I mean, I already knew that it was acclaimed. Many people had recommended it to me, you know, from different areas, like, you know, both people in creative fields, but people in more, for example, like, you know, my friends who were like in advertising, they had also recommended it to me as a film that was different, that broke the mold in many ways in thinking about sci-fi, and also in thinking about representation of Asian Americans on screen, that it sort of, you know, went against stereotypes that we were, you know, used to seeing. And not just in terms of breaking stereotypes, in terms of like an anti-stereotype, you know, but really thinking beyond those categories.
I understand that this film trying to portray the world through the eyes of Asian Americans, but I think it's very interesting to see the mother-daughter relationship portrayed in this film. Honestly speaking, it doesn't look that realistic to me. We also talk about in the class, there are some students from like Asian background also find it unrealistic. It just, like, for example, the ending that love can resolve everything, it's just overly simple and quite unlikely to happen in reality. That differences in terms of reaction lead me to realize within Asian community, there are lots of differences and there are lots of different eyes when looking at one single film work.
Right. So, you know, I would think about this just as you mentioned it from several different angles that perhaps intersect in some way. And we talked about this in our class as well, about how there was a kind of a Hollywood ending, mm-hmm, right, mm-hmm. to this. So even beyond the sort of politics of Asian Americans and Asians, you know, as we called it in the mm-hmm. class, just the Hollywoodization, if you will, of this kind of ending that ties up really nicely with sci-fi, you know, it does. There is something to consider there, and that also I think has an impact or was a factor in its popularization beyond a kind of niche sci-fi or even, you know, like Asian American film to reach the kinds of height of popularity it has with the Oscars. So that's one way of looking at it. Another way of looking at it, you know, I think I would agree that it seems as if the overarching sense that love can solve everything, you know, as you mentioned, it is a bit jarring, I suppose, because some of the tensions, especially the intergenerational tensions, but also, you know, the sexuality, mm-hmm. the tensions with sexuality and with gender as well. You know, they cross over generations. Mm-hmm. And if we think about the comparison, I remember, you know, when I first watched, for example, Joy Luck Club, mm-hmm. Which, you know, you mentioned in, you know, when we first began this conversation, at least in the interview schedule, that got me thinking. When I first watched it, I had just moved from Singapore to Australia. And I was like, 19, 18 years old. So it wasn't Asian American per se, but there was this sense I had begun thinking about what it meant to have an identity as a kind of immigrant in a Western country. And for me, Joy Luck Club had a lot of tensions that remained unresolved. You know, and in fact, towards the end of the film, I still remember this quite clearly because it made such an impression on me, is that it is a kind of rehearsal or restaging of a kind of ritual that leaves things unsaid, mm-hmm. that leaves threads, you know.
That's a pretty typical Asian way to leave the battle, you know, a pretty typical way of dealing with conflicts. And no intervening until a resolution naturally emerged. The ending of EEAO, where the character played by Michelle Yeoh explicitly tells her daughter that she loves her and she will always support her no matter what kind of decision she makes. That scene looks quite bizarre to me, perhaps because it deviates from the expected Asian culture norms of indirect communication. Another movie I wanted to point out in this conversation is Turning Red. I think it was also an Oscar nomination for last year or the year before. I don't remember exactly, but it also is based on an Asian family experience and also focused on mother-daughter relationship and addresses to some generational problems. But it's animation, and we probably have different criteria when looking at it. Have you watched that?
I haven't seen it, but I have read some think pieces on it. You know, Kate, if this is taking you off track, then, you know, feel free to, mm-hmm. to bring us back on track. Do you know these TikTok kind of videos about Korean mom or like, you know, Asian mom versus white mom?
I can imagine
So yeah, so you can imagine how it goes. So, you know, white mom is like really supportive, you know, tells you you're special all the time, gives you hugs all the time, whereas Asian mom, especially Korean mom, somehow, you know, is always sort of very distant and not even distant, but actively sort of pushing the daughter away. And it's always the daughter because, you know, like this film as well encapsulates this idea that, you know, this is a mother-daughter relationship and there are many differences, you know, if it was a son, you know, if it was a father-daughter relationship.
Yeah, I think it actually brings up the next question. Asian women will be portrayed in different way. As Asian wives, they are passive. They don't have their own voices. As mothers, just as you mentioned about those TikTok videos, they maintain a distance from their children. They're strict in education, etc., etc. However, when Asian women are just women or individual women, it's quite likely to be sexualized. So it brings to the character in EEAAO is quite unique in this way because all differences come together. She's both a mother and a wife, but also possessing subjectivity and autonomy. That's where my curiosity takes off, whether the portrayal of protagonist is truly embracing agency and autonomy in contrast to stereotypical representation of Asian women characters, which are always, you know, the ornaments or the decoration.
Right. I mean, you know, when you mentioned it, it seemed to tap into many other kinds of tropes and many other kinds of, you know, I would say roles and maybe even stereotypes that we've seen in other films. So definitely, you know, this is a sci-fi film where women and Asian women particularly, you know, they do have a lot of agency. Their stories dominate and their desires or, you know, their trajectories really dominate the narrative. And here, you know, in the class, we also thought and discussed how in other sci-fi films, perhaps, this was not so. So the contrast definitely is there. And when I was looking at the schedule that you proposed, the interview schedule, I thought about how the mother angle or the mother role, one of the factors to consider in that is the sexualization. Because when the mother takes on, you know, when Michelle Yeoh, for example, takes on this kind of mother role, she explicitly becomes desexualized. Because we see her through different roles, right, within the film itself. In the world or in the trajectory in which she has no children, she becomes very glamorized. You know, she's... So Exactly. You know, she has all the glamour there and is explicitly sexualized. And even when she's in the hot dog world, there's also sexualization there. Whereas in all the other worlds, you know, especially in the actual tax world that she's in, you know, she's portrayed in a way in which her sexuality is de-emphasized, even in relation to her husband. You know, so that's something to consider as well. Whereas the films that we discussed in the class, I think, do we discuss Cloud Atlas? Maybe not, but we discussed other films such as Ex Machina, where the Asian fembot trope was very present.
It was presented in a passive way.
Right. It was present in a passive way, but the sexualization was kind of an overarching factor in the objectification. You know, it was a, you know, this is a classic kind of like sexual object kind of representation.
So shall we go back to the very original question, like why sci-fi? Because Ex Machina is a sci-fi work, and why sci-fi is an important realm to look at the racial issue. What's special about cyberspace?
Well, okay, so the theory or the framework, the conceptual paradigm of ornamentalism gives us some clues there. First up, the first thing that I would consider is how sci-fi itself has been a staging ground for thinking about anxieties or for processing Western anxieties about Eastern progress, about Eastern, you know, technological prowess, especially, you know, during the cyberpunk era towards Japan, and then, you know, as it has gone along towards the other East Asian countries or cultures. So that's one aspect of it, that it's a kind of, you know, place, a genre, in order to process these kinds of anxieties, these contemporary anxieties. Another aspect of it is about the idea of the Asiatic femininity as a kind of embodiment of technology itself, right? Because the Asian woman or the Asian female, especially, you know, as represented in these sci-fi films is always presented as thin, light, live, flexible, you know, and extreme
aesthetic calls within it.
Right. Exactly. And almost, you know, effective to the point that it blends in seamlessly into the other technological systems around it, you know. So that's part of the utility of this kind of conceptual paradigm, is that it allows us to think about the ornament, or to think about Asiatic femininity as kind of, you know, embodying these tensions or these anxieties about the East, but also in a way, you know, you aesthetically sort of, you know, embodying a kind of idea about both technology and about Asiatic femininity specifically.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to mention Lisa Kimura. I was trying to going back to her book, this is Cyber Types, which also touched upon a concept about techno-ornamentalism and Orientalism as well. It basically refers to the representation of Asian bodies and technologies, often portraying Asian characters entering cyber world without an actual embodiment. That really reminds me the movies of EAO and also After Young, the one I highly recommend to all the classes. Both of them challenge traditional representation of Asian characters as passive objects or decoration. For example, in EAO, the protagonist is an Asian female that possesses subjectivity and autonomy, whereas in After Young, the protagonist is a boat, but it's a male boat. It's not a female boat. And this male boat is completely broken and needed to be fixed. That's a very interesting character to look at. So I'm wondering if these are attempting to break away from traditional or stereotypical ornamentalism by presenting Asian characters with agency and subjectivity, whether they are human or artificial entities.
Right. I mean, I think you're right on that level, in that it is trying to break free of that stereotype. But on the other hand, right, there is still a residual sense that it is that the aesthetic of the ornament remains, at least from my reading of it. Right. If you think about it, the essence, you know, of the two main female characters, they are constantly changing their garments. They're constantly changing the scenes that they are in. It's almost as if, you know, they are this kind of technological object that can take on many different forms. And by taking on many different forms, it does not have a body in and of itself. You know, and, you know, in the words, since I have these quotes in front of me right now from Anne Ching's and An Ling Ching's, you know, ornamentalism, you know, this Asiatic female body is ornament. So if we think about these two female characters, the flesh that is not flesh, the perfect model, a streamlined figure capable not just sustaining, but also being the surface, and ontologically so conditional as to be wholly compatible with the digital network. I mean, just think about the film. Isn't that what it is? There is a kind of... Exactly, you know, there is a kind of network that they're hooked up to, right? And there is a kind of, you know, streamlined capability that somehow both of them tap into because of their, I don't know, biological connection.
So the flexibility itself become, I would say, a new trap of understanding Asian representation, right? At least in sci-fi films, even though it looks like there are lots of freedom and there are lots of changes, the character is able to jump from one verse to another verse, but eventually when it goes back to embodiment, they don't have a fixed body and they don't have a fixed stable image. Instead, a constant transition from one shape to another shape.
I think that's one way of understanding it. So it's not the only way, of course. So on the surface, like you said, you know, this is a kind of bucking against the stereotype, right, of the ornament, at least in the Ex Machina vein. But on the other hand, you know, this is another level to read this text, that it gets away from that. But at the same time, at least for me, thinking about this as we're talking makes it seem as if some things have changed, but some things have remained the same. That the ornamentalist aesthetic, or at least the form, right? So on the surface, it's changed, but the form of it remains the same, at least to some extent.
Do you think there will be some reflection on the Asian community in reality? It seems like there are lots of improvement, some positive development. However, I do think there are still challenges and barriers for at least Asian American community to face in achieving true diverse and authentic representation in media and films. Though we have someone like Michelle Yeoh holding an Oscar, there's still a long way to go in terms of overall representation in and the second census for Asian American in, let's say, film industry.
Yeah, I think you know, for that, you know, we can think about the spectacle of the Oscars, mm-hmm. right? And we talked about this in our class as well. You know, who's the father character in?
I don't remember his name.
Yeah, exactly. You edit this out. When the father character in the film, right, at least in real life, when he accepted the Oscars, he was hugging, you know, Harrison Ford, right? There was a moment in which I cringed. And, you know, when we discussed it in the class, all of us cringed because it seemed like it was parodying, or when it was done or when it was performed in that way, it was meant to be a heartwarming moment. But for many, you know, Asians and Asian Americans, it felt as if, you know, the progress had been in a way extinguished. The progress of, you know, this actor, this child actor, had been extinguished because, you know, his success was contingent upon, you know, the, in a way.
Yeah, that's weird. I feel cringe at the moment when he brought up American Dreams. I was like, are you sure you wanted to talk about American Dreams right at this point in these circumstances? That's so weird.
Exactly. And you know, it is a kind of Hollywood ending to, or at least the chapter of his story, right? But hugging Harrison Ford, you know, in that moment, because of his child acting role as I think it was, what was his name in the Indiana Jones series?
It doesn't have a proper name, just a nickname or something.
You know, it just goes to show how all the progress that he's made as an actor, and yet, you know, the height of his achievement has to be validated by Harrison Ford, a white man who at the beginning of his career, you know, at least on screen, he didn't have a proper name, you know, in that script, at least. So for me, you know, it was a bittersweet moment. And it also felt like, I don't quite remember the term. I'm sure there is a term in Asian American studies, but in, you know, in thinking about like Black representation, it, you know, for Black culture, it's kind of like an Uncle Tom moment, right? When a Black character is sort of trying to pander towards the white man. So there is a similar trope, I think, in Asian American representation, where the Asian person is trying to pander to, you know, white tastes, you know, or like, you know, a white validation in some way. And for me, that's kind of a cringe moment. You know, there's some things to unpack there. Perhaps, you know, you have some thoughts on that, but it's still unprocessed for me.
I can't help but going back to my personal experience. I have to admit that even though I studied sociology before, but I haven't seriously think about racial issues until I took this course this year, which prompted me to give more thoughts on my own identity as Asian. And I have to point out that compared to the population in Canada, which appears to be more diverse, Asian occupies a decent amount of population. In the UK, it's obviously the opposite. So this change of environment really has triggered a re-evaluation of my own identity, pushed me to acknowledge my Asianness and my Chinese heritage within the broader spectrum of ethnicity. and then so to gain deeper understanding of the complexities and nuance of tension around different racial groups. So I believe that was the Uncle Tom moment in my personal experience that lead. So that was the moment of confronting to the modern minority myth lights up my interest of the Netflix show, in which the two protagonists, they are not perfect at all. They almost like fuck up their lives. And the role Ali Wong plays, I think it was Amy or something. She looks quite successful. She has her own business and she has a nice family, and her husband is also a famous artist. So everything looks perfect, but internally, she is about like at the edge of breakdown. And the character Danny, he's like the average loser, and he's also a second generation of a Korean immigrant family, so carry lots of expectation from the parents. And also, apparently, he's also at the edge of breakdown. These two characters are not perfect by all means, and they cannot be seen as models for their own ethnicity group. But these two imperfect people are the main characters for a television show. That's why I found it so interesting.
Okay, yeah. Thank you for adding that caveat, because I only watched one episode. Yeah, indeed. I mean, I was super excited, you know, when I saw the promo, the trailer for this series, because finally, you know, there was an entire series, you know, in which all the characters had different roles to play, who were all Asian American, different kinds of Asian Americans. You know, Ali Wong, you know, is Chinese Vietnamese, and then you know Steven Yeung is Korean. Okay. And, you know, there's a Japanese character as well. And these are mirrored within the film, within the TV series itself. So, you know, the TV series, these characters, they do embody these different cultural backgrounds. And also the class differences. I think that's an important point to make. One thought that I had, and perhaps, you know, this is me being a bit skeptical. It seemed very... like a kind of, you know, equity, diversity, and inclusion checkbox, like class checkbox, you know, race, you know, or culture checkbox. Because these are all exactly these are all the criticisms that, you know, that that have been levied against Asian American representations in the U.S. at least. You know, so for me, it felt like it fulfilled that role. I had not watched the second episode and go further, but I do understand that it is indeed a complex narrative, you know, that unfolds thereof. And certainly it does buck the trend of the model minority kind of, you know, stereotype or the model minority framework in which a lot of characters, but also actual people embroiled in, you know.
Surprisingly, these series raise lots of attention and discussion in Chinese-speaking community, and they find themselves resonate with the characters. They can understand the internal struggles, even though these audiences are raised in a completely different cultural environment. They're still able to understand the struggles and all the mental breakdowns. That's what I find super, super interesting to look at. I guess it is because when you stop portraying people as, you know, perfect models, you actually make them more realistic, more like real people. And so it's able to make more audiences find easier to resonate with.
Oh, I love that, because now you've just convinced me to watch the entire series and to put it in my module for next term.
There's so many films that you should. That you really should. Well, even though you haven't watched it, but I still wanted to mention After Yang and Beef and also Turning Red. I wonder if they can be regarded as new exploration for picturing Asian on screen, regardless of whether they're perfect or not. Can these film works or these animation works be regarded as attempt to untangle ornamentalism?
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's
you have to give a perfect answer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a complex question, you know, and before, maybe this can be a segue into that. One thought that I had just, you know, with our brief discussion about beef is that it sets the scene for a kind of inter-Asian tensions, which, you know, both of us are Asians. We both understand that, of course, there are tensions. The moment I went into my my class in when I was an undergraduate in Australia, you know, I met folks from Hong Kong, folks from, you know, from Taiwan, you know, from China. They're very different from me as a Singaporean. And there were a lot of tensions there. And in fact, I wrote some of my best, you know, like undergraduate essays on specifically this tension, which is unacknowledged, which is, okay, not unacknowledged, but under-acknowledged in discussions about representation, racial representation in the Western media overall. So I think that's an important sort of aspect to really grasp and to really like emphasize that we need more of that, that not all Asians are the same, you know, at all. And in fact, you know, the tensions thereof, they almost result from the model minority a framework, because then it pits Asians against each other in a way. Mm-hmm. Another thing to emphasize, and this comes out of our discussions in class, you know, about Get Out. When we're watching Get Out, right? One of the main sort of things in the reading for that week was
that most complicated one.
Yes, it was the most complicated one. It was by Zakiya Jackson, and what was the title of it?
Posthumanism.
Yeah, becoming human. So yeah, all right. I hope you can edit all this out. So that one of the readings that came from that was that why do these films or why do these representations that they shouldn't involve white characters at all? That white characters are not part of it at all. And that was, you know, that was one of the things that was emphasized from in that book, as well as that book's readings of other texts. So beef does that, right?
I can't say that. There are two white characters in the show, and one of them just a very minor one appears only one or two times, I guess. Well, the other one is a female who is a boss of a chain supermarket, quite a successful businesswoman. I believe this female character might carry some intention from the directors to represent colonization, to symbolize Western colonization. And there are some symbols hinted at it in the episodes. But I still think the portrayal of these characters is quite vague. The symbolization of colonization and its consequences appear to be vague as well, even though they are crucial to the understanding of struggles faced by the characters. So I think this ambiguity could be problematic for this show because it really prevents deeper and clearer understanding of the role colonization and imperialism play in the context of racial struggle. But these are simply my understanding. I hope there's no spoiler to you.
Okay, so to be continued. this conversation to be continued. So going back to, you know, our original question in the time that we have, your question was about how are we undoing, you know, are these films or, you know, are these media representations, are they undoing or at least sort of, you know, pushing against ornamentalism? So what I will say to that is that oftentimes, you know, when I talk to students about, you know, diversity and representation in the media, I wouldn't say it's a solution, but the way to address it mm-hmm. is oftentimes, I would say, you know, it's more straightforward. It doesn't have to be complicated. It can be straightforward, right? Because it relates to a diversity of representations on screen, right? And it relates also to the complexity of the kinds of stories that can be told, right? So you can look at it from two angles. So on one hand, you know, you can look at it aesthetically, you know, as we've done. But on the other hand, you know, we can also look at it more sociologically, you know, we can look at across a spread of different kinds of media representations. Is there enough diversity there, right, for other Asian Americans or other, you know, British Asians to, when they watch, see themselves reflected so that they do not see themselves, you know, through the mirror of stereotypes? You know, if that is present and they're enough, then not all of them have to be positive. Not all of them have to be, you know, exactly. Exactly, exactly. They don't all have to be one type, but they can, you know, some of them can be rich, some of them can be poor, you know, some of them can be, you know, criminals, you know, some of them can be doctors and lawyers, as long as there are enough. And not only the counting, not only, you know, like in terms of quantitatively, but also qualitatively, if the stories are interesting enough and complex enough so that they're not just one dimensional, you know, then I think that in and of itself is a kind of triumph, you know. So that's on the sociological aspect, and that can speak to ornamentalism. Because if there is a diversity of representations on screen, then for some of it to be ornamentalist, I don't think it's that much of an issue because it's one out of many. You see what I'm saying? But like, let's say when there is an overall pattern within sci-fi that you can identify all these different, you know, Asiatic femininity is represented in this way, when it becomes a trope, then that's where there is a sort of issue there. So the issue perhaps, you know, is also with the genre of sci-fi itself, you know, or at least the current trajectory that it is following, or the current stage in which it's at.
But wouldn't that go back to the question about plasticity? I remember this term, but I have to admit that it's so hard to understand. I find it so difficult to fully get what this concept is trying to say. At this point, my understanding so far is that it's developed to address to blackness, where you already able to see lots of shapes and lots of different representations, yet there's no a stable image. So wouldn't these two be a little bit contradictory?
What do you mean? Can you say more about that?
So we were saying the range of diversity should be expanded in terms of quantity, but also in terms of quality. All sorts of representation should show. Then what define, for example, in this case, yellowness? What's the pivot when someone is trying to construct self-identification from a racial perspective, when there's no guideline, there's no clear rule, no concrete model, no stable image, where are we heading to?
All right. Yeah, I mean, like, I think that's an interesting sort of thread to pull, right, in terms of thinking more deeply about what diversity in media representation entails and what the implications of that are. But I think you know, perhaps it's useful to sort of clarify the different levels of analysis, right, that we're at. Okay, so if you want to think about plasticity of Asian representation on screen in a sort of meta way, not within a single text, then yeah, that sounds like it could be very useful, because at least my understanding of plasticity as a conceptual paradigm is that it's not just about being different things, but it's about being everything and nothing all at once. Like you say, you know, there's no stable image. And one of the key takeaways for me from that framework, that theoretical framework, is the idea of like a matrix or of a womb. Like or even like a 3D printer, right? like it could be anything, but the basis of it is, you know, this plastic material that doesn't have shape or form on its own, and it takes on, you know, whatever the power structures allow it to take on. I think that, you know, that if we want to take a step back, which is why, you know, throughout the class, I encourage the students, but also myself, to challenge ourselves to see how these frameworks can stack up against each other, you know, or can be integrated in some way, or not as a theoretical exercise, but as a political exercise. To what extent, you know, what is the utility of putting these different frameworks, which are, you know, at least ostensibly incompatible, what's the utility of putting that up against each other? What is the utility of comparing, you know, blackness as an aesthetic category with Asianness, you know, or yellowness as an aesthetic category? And I think, you know, it's a difficult task, you know, but it can be very fulfilling. But it depends on the scope of the analysis and the text at hand, or texts at hand. So I can't really answer that, but, you know, we can continue prodding at it.
There always hold a lot to ponder around, but we have to probably stop here because we both have meetings to go. But, you know, thank you very much for this very insightful conversation. And is there any last word you wanted to add?
No, just, you know, thank you, Selena, for this lovely conversation. It's, you know, it's always great to, you know, to chat about these things, especially in the context of these contemporary events.
Yeah,
you know,
there are lots of things coming up, and I think it's keep refreshing the conversation about Asian representation on screen, and they keep going new materials for us to talk.
Right, definitely.
And please go watch.
I will. I will watch Beef and I will watch After Young. All right, this, you know, that's definitely next on my list.
This is the takeaway for today.
Exactly.
以上是今天的全部内容。我推荐你关注并订阅读报的 Telegram 频道，那里有更多的阅读手记和个人化写作。感谢你对节目的收听，并欢迎分享。我们相信，总有人对外面的世界有所兴趣与好奇。멈춰 섰어 두 머리 위로